No, I don't want to write a book about this. I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to be this. I hadn't even fully accepted my experience that I was a suicide widow. It takes a long time to even reclaim your identity or rebuild a new identity after you have such a huge thing happen in your life.
What if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed, not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. When her life shifted from fairy tale to nightmare due to her husband's death by suicide, Michelle Ann Collins found herself in the darkest place imaginable, reaching for answers to questions like, how am I going to eat, sleep, get out of bed, and do all the things? As a yoga therapist and wellness coach, she had more tools than many suicide loss survivors do. And yet, escaping the dark grief cave required the most excruciating work of her life. Tune in to hear Michelle share what compelled her to write two books about such a horrible tragedy, and some of the practices that helped her escape the grief cave. Plus, if you're a companion of a suicide loss survivor, you're going to hear some of the most important do's and don'ts for supporting them on their grief journey. It's time. Get a cup of something yummy and enjoy these sips of story and sanity with us. Hello, and welcome to Sips of Story and Sanity, where we talk about the stories behind the stories with authors, speakers, and thought leaders. A few of my partners here at Saved by Story, my son, Aaron.
Hello.
And some clients turned friends turned partners, Teddy.
Hi, y'all.
And Lori.
Hello, everyone.
And Carlin.
Hi there.
Are here to help us make sure that we get the most delicious sips of story and sanity out of this experience. And it is going to be a very delicious day. We have the founder of Inhabit Joy, Michelle Ann Collins, who partners with individuals who have suffered grief, injury, or other types of loss as they recover, reclaim their wholeness, and build resilience for life's inevitable challenges. Michelle, thank you for being here today. This
Thanks
has been,
for having me, Amanda.
Yeah. And I should say that we were talking before we hit record, and most of us are on the tail edge of the tail end of the cold season. So sorry in advance for all the nasally, sniffly sort of comments that you're going to hear today. So Michelle, I'm so excited. We absolutely could not miss this opportunity to talk with you about your books because they're getting ready to launch. I mean, this is like 6 weeks away. and I want the audience to hear that I said books with it. It's plural. You're launching two books into the world, which is just such a remarkable feat. So congratulations on that. And thank you for being here to talk about your process and what you hope readers take away from these incredible books that you put together. So let's start at the beginning. When and where were you when you first thought about writing these books?
That is actually an easier question to answer than you would think, because it was not a subtle, oh, maybe I'll write a book. What should I write a book about? There was none of that. There was, oh, I have all these skills and experiences I might be able to share with someone. No, that's not what happened at all. It was a very loud, booming, aha moment. If you talk to people or beings or believe in that from the other side, I had a message very loud and clear from God, the universe, spirit, source. It actually happened. I can tell you the day it happened. It was April 23rd, 2017. I had just spread my husband's ashes in the ocean off of Maui in this beautiful little cove where we went snorkeling a year before that, 2 years before that. And I just was driving back to my little rented condo, and I literally had a voice come booming into the car and say, "You have to write a book." It was that clear.
Wow.
I had no intention to write a book about suicide or even ever talk about suicide, suicide loss survival. Three very different things. Yeah, so
And it was still kind
that's
of
how it
a
happened.
fresh, it was a fresh experience, right? How long after he passed did you?
That was 1 year to the day. I spread his ashes on the 1 year anniversary.
Wow. And what was your initial reaction? That's a big experience to have while you're driving home from such a momentous experience.
It was a big experience. My initial reaction, does this podcast allow cussing?
It does.
I believe it was something along the lines of, "What the fuck? No. I don't want to write a book about this. I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to be this." I hadn't even fully accepted my experience that I was a suicide widow. It takes a long time to even reclaim your identity or rebuild a new identity after you have such a huge thing happen in your life. And positive too, your identity changes as you go through any major life event. And so the idea of writing about it to help others, which was part of the message, right? Write this so you can help others survive the way you have. And at the time, 1 year out, I didn't really feel like much of a survivor at all. I felt like I had been destroyed by this experience. My life had been completely destroyed, is how I felt at the time. And I think a lot of people who go through, grief and trauma feel that way for a long time, not just a year. So no, my initial reaction to the message from the universe was, hell no.
So, did you start or did you resist for a while?
No, I started actually. I had a couple more days on the island and I started writing. I had an outline, a very simple outline. It was, 10 things to do when your spouse dies by suicide. And as things happen, 2 days after that experience, I got a call that my closest aunt had passed away, and I had to jump on a plane and go home and grieve with my family. So that kind of took my mind away from the project for a bit to have this second experience happen in such short succession.
Yeah. So I'm curious how much you're, I know that as I worked with you through the process of working on this book and some iterations of it before, we talked, it's always, especially when you're dealing with a tender topic like this, how much of someone else's story do I share? Right. But I think the important part for our listeners and for people who are reading the book, because I don't think that this is something that's true for just you, is that before this happened, there were other things that were going on. So his passing was kind of like one of the final bits of trauma that were taking place, right? And so is there anything that you normally share with people about, what was leading up to that? And because I feel like It's one thing for people to grieve a suicide loss. I mean, how awful. And then also all of the things that come before. Different for everybody, but I wonder if there are some commonalities and themes that you would like to share.
Sure, yeah, it is someone else's story, and I think that's a really great point that you make, because as much as I lost my husband to suicide, he had a whole story leading up to that point, and we had a whole story with our relationship. And what I've learned in studying, for my grief educator certification and studying about suicide loss and speaking with other suicide loss survivors, is it is all over the place. I mean, some people you'll hear had absolutely no knowledge of anything unusual happening. And I also mentor through TAPS, Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, people who are connected to the military who lost a loved one through suicide. And the stories that I've heard, I mean, it really is all over. Some of them, they were in the midst of taking their lives when they were discovered by their spouse, and so they knew it was coming because they saw it happen. Or they've been trying, in my case, trying for months to get, I tried for months to get Glenn the help that I hoped would keep him from taking his life, because he had been threatening for several months. And then there's people who have no idea. A policeman shows up at their door, and they had no idea anything was happening. So, as much as suicide is common, the times leading up to it, for my personal experience, the months leading up to it were incredibly traumatic. Glenn was really struggling, and I began to feel unsafe. And I think I talk only a little bit about this in the book, but I had asked him to move out because I was fearful. And that so then when he did, just a few weeks later, take his life, of course, that caused even more profound guilt. All suicide loss survivors have guilt. Actually, all grievers have guilt. Guilt is a big thing in grief, no matter who you lost. So but the suicide definitely adds a layer, and it was really a heavy load.
Yeah. So I can imagine just the reaction to, writing a book to help other people, because I know a lot of the things that you share in this book were just around, I mean, we've had so many conversations about how badly our culture does grief, or maybe doesn't do grief. It's probably more the point, right? We're not really equipped to deal with it, and to have any sort of healthy perspective around it while we're moving through it when it's expected, let alone when it's unexpected. And then there's all the logistics. I'm working on a few books right now where they're talking about losing loved ones, and the logistics of what has to take place after someone passes in any way are just horrifying. I mean, there's so many things to do that keep someone from actually starting the process of grieving, right? Because they have to attend to all of these things. And then, you finally get to the point. And so I know some of what you share in this book is just around the monumentous task of trying to handle what he left behind, with just all of the details of his state. And I just, every time I read through that section, I get this image of you sitting at your dining room table with, stacks of paperwork kind of up above your face, thinking like, how did you even, so when you thought, write a book for survivors, what were the things that came to you immediately? Were they more of those like practical, tasky things, like how to get through the really horrible, stupid stuff that has to be done? Or was it more of the emotional piece based on where you were and
I
you
think
can.
probably at the beginning, that's a great question too. How did this come together, right? As the book that's going out into the world, January 26th. Because I think at the beginning it was just the stepwise, tasks, the task oriented, what do you do to get through this time? And then as I continued to heal and go on my grief journey, I realized that one of the most important things, and I hope I got this across in the book in a whole bunch of different ways, is that you don't have to do everything all at once. You get it, first of all, and I did teach a little bit of the neuroscience in the book as well, that it's so hard to make a decision when you're under stress. And there's neuroscience behind that. There's reasons for that, which I'm not going to go into on the podcast. But when you're grieving or in trauma or post-traumatic, it's really hard to make a rational decision. Like, for example, who should I invite to the funeral? Not that you would have a list, but how do I get the information out there that people need? What do I do with his stuff? What do I, how do I contact all the agencies and all that that need to be contacted before you even start processing the paperwork? So it's a really, it's like somebody dies by suicide or not, and then all of a sudden you get handed this huge project and you're the project manager. It's the opposite of what you need. What you need is to just crawl into your grief cave and just hide for a while and try to heal till you can even start, knowing whether it's day or night. I mean, you're so overwhelmed with emotion, and your thinking brain is so hijacked by feelings. It's nearly impossible when you can't even eat or drive. I mean, the first few weeks after Glenn died, I literally could not drive. I did not have the executive function to manage working an automobile. So, and I'm supposed to be planning a funeral and ordering death certificates. And so that's really a lot of where the book got its start, was you don't have to do everything all at once. When you're ready, do one small thing. And if you can't do one small thing today, you can go to bed and breathe. You can do those two things, and just to reassure people, there's time. You don't have to do everything today. There's time. I mean, Glenn's estate took 2 years to close.
Wow.
There was time.
Yeah. So, I mean, who wants to write a book about this topic at all, let alone have to go back and think about including some of your story and, having helped people through the process of sharing their stories for 15 years now. Like the resistance to this, the internal resistance to this process is usually so great. So how did that show up for you, and how did you navigate it? Why didn't you give up?
That's a great question, but I actually did give up.
Oh.
I tried to do something else, and I kept whatever the power behind that voice that gave me the command or the message to write the book. It was powerful enough to make sure that I didn't get too far off of my journey, because I kept having more and more obstacles happen in my life. Social, financial, vocational, all these, everything was really, really difficult. I had a lot of physical, a lot of illness and injury and all this, and I'm a very spiritual person. So when I'm not functioning, I try to, well, after I go to the doctor and get tests, I'm and they say, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. Like, yeah, except I can't move my arm. Then I start asking a little bit deeper, what is going on in my life? What choices am I making that might be being interfered, my progress might be being interfered with? And So I went back. I had to. I felt like I didn't have a choice at that point. This is like 3 or 4 years out, from when I got the message. And I remember actually, Amanda, I called you or emailed you after I figured out that that was what was going to do it. And that story I wrote about in the You Can't Make This Story Up book. I wrote the details of that journey that we wrote together. I had to do it. I was trying to write a different book that was more broad and what I would consider more interesting, easier to write, because it was just about how to get through hard things and be healthy and meditate and mindfulness. And yeah, that's not what the universe or God or spirit was holding out for me. So I remember I called you and I said, Amanda, remember this book that I didn't want to write 3 years ago? Well, that has to happen. And I was right.
Yeah. And once you got into it, it happened kind of quickly. I mean, I know it never feels quick when you're in the writing process, but by comparison, you move through
It's
that
well, it's
process.
been what, about 2 years since I made that phone call to you. I think, if my years are right. I
Two
don't
books,
know. It's all a blur.
two So you mentioned the grief cave. Earlier, and this is a really important metaphor that you use through the process of unfolding the journey for the reader. And there's this really beautiful image on your front cover of your lotus with people climbing up, right? And trying to get to the summit. It's just such a good representation. But I'd love for you to share a little bit more about the grief cave and where that idea came from and why you decided to run with it.
Well, great. I love your questions. Just gonna bask in that for a minute. I think it's really important for meaningful grieving or, productive grieving. I don't know if there's a good word for it, because any kind of grief, you can't grieve wrong. There's no incorrect grieving, but I have a few examples of ways that I have grieved in my life, and then also that I've been taught about grief. And one of them comes from my culture, from Judaism. And in Judaism, it is actually Judaism is fairly culturally aware of grief and loss, and we have a pretty good formula for what to do when someone dies. And it includes diving into that grief cave for the first week after the person is buried. You spend the entire time just in pure, deep grief. And everybody comes, it's called sitting Shiva. Everyone comes to your house, brings food, takes care of the kids, whatever you need. And all your only job during that time is to grieve, just cry, whatever you need to do, stay in bed all day, and be supported by your community. So this was my earliest example of what to do. And then if you fast forward to when I lost my mom, I was 41 when my mom died of from leukemia. And I didn't, it wasn't even because it was prescribed by the culture of Judaism. It was because I absolutely had to go to bed. After the funeral, I was paralyzed with grief, literally. And I was really fortunate to have people to take my kids to school, make sure there was food, all that kind of thing. But so I think it's really important that people understand that it's a necessary thing to feel the feelings. And I talk about that a lot in the book too, to actually go through it. The only way through is through, right? And if you can allow yourself to feel and grieve, and again, it doesn't have to be all at once, but if there's a process, and that's what I try to outline in the book, for allowing grief, for saying, yeah, this sucks, I'm not gonna just go to work on Monday, 2 days after my husband died, and pretend nothing happened. And so that's the grief cave. You crawl into the grief cave as soon as you realize what happened, or maybe before you realize what happened, and you stay in there as long as you need to until you can feel like you can take any tiny step back out into the light. It's a safe and important place to go.
Yeah, and you've divided the book into a few parts, really looking at I mean, your background as a wellness coach with the Ayurvedic training and everything that you know, the yoga, right? Like all these practices that you had walking into this tragedy. And so I love seeing how those things came into play and supported you through the process once you were able to do them, right? It took a minute. But also to see, how you've unfolded this to have to really attend to the body first and then to look at what's happening with the mind, how to get the mind focused and then in the end, that process of building resilience. Is there anything that you want to say about that process and that unfolding for the reader?
I think that that in yoga there are when you're talking about the body or the being, the physical being, there are different layers called the koshas, and the first kosha is the physical body, and then it goes the breath, the mind, all the way to what would be pure spirit. And so the book, I didn't purposely model it after the koshas, but I think it was informed by that. And also based on my own experience, you have to breathe, right? That's the first thing you have to do is breathe and take stock and kind of figure out where you are after a big life-altering tragedy or event. So after the first thing you do is, okay, where am I? Right. And so that's why I modeled the book after sort of the journey, right? I keep mentioning the journey and climbing because it's very much effortful. And I like to climb, I like to hike, and it takes effort. And sometimes it's just 1 foot in front of the other. And that's true of grieving too.
Yeah, and I love how, especially through, I think that the part two is my favorite because you really dive into the pieces that stop people from grieving, kind of like get them stuck in a holding pattern, right? The what you mentioned before, the guilt. Like, how do you deal with those feelings when you can't necessarily talk to the person and apologize or sort things out? How do you forgive? How do you manage relationships through this time period? So all of those pieces, I think, just that the incredible message that you keep repeating through this book is just like it's okay to stop and breathe and reassess and keep moving forward. And when you're ready, that piece of like you don't have to force it. So you had all these incredible tools and practices for people at the beginning of the journey. If you could choose one or two just to share with our listeners who might, be like, wow, this is too many weeks until I can get my hands on this book. Can you hand me my first two things that I can do? What would those be?
Sure, and I think also in the book, I use a lot of different metaphors, partly just because I like metaphors, and I think as you all know, story helps, right, to understand. And so I think that the creating a metaphor, like the journey, right? Like the hiking is one tool you can use, and realizing that if you can't wrap your head around, oh, I lost my spouse, think of it as a broken leg. That's one of my favorite metaphors, because we don't wear grief on the outside, although in Judaism we do for that first week wear a torn cloth is part of the tradition, so people know, look, I'm in grief right now. I'm a primary mourner, and I am grieving hard. So it is a way of being seen. But if you can just give yourself grace, that's really the biggest tool. Just it's okay. Whatever's happening, don't be hard on yourself, because you're grieving, and then you're going to add self-deprecation on top of that. Really? That's like, oh, I broke my leg, and now I'm going to run over my broken leg with my car. I mean, it's not where the direction you want to go. So that, and also find a way to self-soothe that is not damaging to your health. If you need to binge, this is us this week, to just give your brain a rest, do that, and give yourself permission to do that. If you need to take two or three baths a day, because the bathtub's the only place you feel comfortable to just sit and cry, and maybe it smells good, maybe you can relax your muscles and just be, give yourself permission to do what feels a little bit less bad than the full-blown pain.
Even with all of your tools, what's something that you wish you had either remembered more at the beginning or known that you didn't know?
Well, certainly the two things I just said. I was so hard on myself. I couldn't make a phone call, or some days I could make one phone call to one agency to ask one question, and that was it. I was overwhelmed, and I was functioning at such a low level. And then on top of that, I added, "How lame are you?" the voice in my head. So I was kicking myself when I was down, not even talking about the way anyone else might have been treating me, or grieving with me, or grieving in front of me. And so I think that's the main thing. I wish I could have experienced more compassion, more self-compassion. And I mean, there's courses on self-compassion, and there's an institute of self-compassion. So it's a real thing. It makes a really big difference in how you live your life. And I've developed a really nice self-compassion practice, but that didn't start until at least a year into my journey. Boy, is it a relief when you quit picking on yourself. Oh, so beautiful. It's like the clouds parting and the sun coming out. I'll say it one more way. Treat yourself like you would a friend. I mean, if a friend of yours lost, is deep in grief, you're not going to go over there and like, why haven't you cleaned the house? Why haven't you gotten out of bed? I mean, you're going to go over there and bring them soup and rub their neck, and try to like take their dog for a walk or whatever. You're going to try to lighten their load. Yet the things we do to ourselves, so mean. So yeah, treat yourself the way that you would a grieving friend. How about that?
So speaking of friends, we got to the end of book one for the survivor, and then I got an email that had a lot of exclamation points, but it wasn't really excitement coming back.
No.
But it was such a brilliant idea, right? To not just offer this amazing resource for survivors, but to help their friends be better.
Thus, the second book.
Yes. So what inspired that?
Same voice, same whatever power force. God, the universe. But this time, when I got that message, I was like, oh, okay. There was no resistance, because after, 5 years, I think it was at the time, 5 years after I got that message, I finally, by the way, I just have to tell the rest of that story. The night I turned my manuscript in to you, the manuscript that's, gonna now be edited and blah, blah, blah. So I finally, after five and a half years, I'm gonna get a break. I'm gonna get to take some time where I'm just like, waiting for edits. That night, I go to bed and I get this order, message, whatever you want to call it. You have to write a companion book, a book for companions. And I just rolled my, I'm like, okay, but I'm not going to start it till tomorrow. I'm going to bed. So then, yes, first thing in the morning, I sent you that message. And just like you did a couple of years ago when I sent you the one about this is the book that has to come first. I was like, Amanda, I have to write a companion book. There might have been some exclamation points and some words that no one needs to hear yet. But it was, I didn't resist it. So, and I already had the template of the first book, which I used. And the second book is just for people who are supporting people. Because what I notice when I'm, moderating grief groups and working with clients through grief coaching, and also, in my grief educator course and in my own experience, what I noticed was there's so much additional difficulty brought on by people not knowing how to support you. So not only do you not know how to grieve, or how to give yourself grace in grief, everyone, there's no one method of grieving. And then, but the people around you don't know what to do either. So again, back to the project image, something terrible happened. Your higher functioning brain is hijacked. Their higher functioning brain is hijacked, because of course they're upset. Even if they weren't close to your spouse, they're upset for you because they care about you. So nobody's thinking clearly. And then all of a sudden you get one of the biggest projects you've ever had to manage in your life. Of course, everyone's going to be at each other. And I'm sure everyone listening to this and watching this, if you think about a time when there was a big ripple, maybe it was a death, maybe it was even a wedding, maybe it was someone got a diagnosis, everybody kind of freaks out and doesn't do the right thing. And that's why. So that's where that book came from. I felt like if I had a chance to educate supporters of grievers, that I should do that too. So there's two books.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just grievers, but I mean, there's a whole other level of care that has to be attended to when it happened by suicide, right? There's just, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't have known without reading your book that certain questions just should not be asked, certain statements, oh my gosh, certain gestures are just a really terrible idea, right? And so I would love for you to share, for those who are listening, who are supporting the people in their lives who have lost someone, what are some of those, top two or three do's and don'ts that they can take with themselves through the holiday? Because if people aren't suffering the loss, an immediate loss, they might be missing someone from the year before or 5 years before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, holidays are definitely, they kind of magnify everything, mm-hmm. because it's so steeped in tradition. I think, yeah, for a supporter, my top three advice, I have so much, it's hard to narrow it down. Number one, I would say let the griever come to you. I mean, definitely say, how are you doing? But if they want to talk, let them talk. If they don't want to talk right now, that's okay too. Offer an activity. Want to go see a movie? Want to go get coffee? And if they're no, I don't want to leave the house, bring them coffee and sit with them. But don't force anything. You've been stuck in the house for weeks. You have to come to the family holiday party. No. If they had just broken their neck and they were paralyzed, you wouldn't say, get out of the hospital and come to the family party. You'd say, what can I bring you? And maybe do you want to zoom in for 5 minutes? And you can also run interference. That's a really big one too. When a griever doesn't want to go somewhere or move or physically can't at the moment, because they're paralyzed by grief, if to have an advocate is so valuable. Have someone say, Amanda doesn't want to, it isn't able to be here today because she's just having a rough time. So that would be one. Also, don't ask if it's a suicide loss and you're not super close to the person and you don't know the cause, the method that the person used, don't ask. And don't ask if you discovered the body. Because when you ask those questions, it's about you. It's about your curiosity. You and we all have it. I'm not even saying that's bad. We all want to know. I understand it. I mean, it's you just have this morbid curiosity. We all do. It's innate. But if you can possibly keep yourself from asking questions, asking details, it would really be great. Because suicide loss survivors don't normally want to talk about that. If they do, and you can listen and you can be present for the gory details when they're ready to talk about it, that's hugely valuable. It really is, because most people can't really sit still and go, oh, I'm so sorry. But if they say my partner used a gun and they stop there, don't ask, oh, was it a pistol or a rifle? Where did they point it? I mean, I actually got questions like that. What caliber? Because Glenn was in the military and he had a lot of military people in his life who know about guns. And what caliber? I mean, seriously. So yeah, just don't ask. If especially if it's a suicide, don't ask the details. If they come out, try to hold space for them. But whatever it was, it wasn't good. And if the person found the body, are you going to ask that question? What are you going to do with that information? Think about that. What do you know when people said, well, did you find him? The answer is yes. I'm the one who discovered Glenn's body after he killed himself. What do you say to that? So that's my point. Don't ask a question that you can't follow up with peer support. It's horrifying. And if the person doesn't want to go into that memory at that time, don't make them. Because it really doesn't matter. You might be curious, but separate your curiosity from your support of your friend. That would be my advice.
Yeah, and I just, as you've been speaking today, and I've thought this before while looking through the book, this this idea of just figuring out how to get the conversation about grief into the culture at a larger, with larger impact, like helping even little kids understand how to deal with all kinds of grief. But I think the other piece for me, it makes me emotional just thinking about it, is, understanding the importance of having a community, of having a network of people, so that when something like this happens, whether it's, an older family member passes and we all were kind of expecting it because of the state of their condition, or someone decides to take their life, there's that network in place before, and I just, that's another skill for grief, right? Is that piece of just having people who know you, who've watched you move through other things before and kind of can think for you. You talked about one of those friends that showed up for you in the beginning and was helping you just get dressed, right? And I just think, like, you know, I'm so grateful that because when my dad passed suddenly, I just froze. And I at the time I wasn't even close to him, but I texted a few of the important, you know, the people closest to me at the time. One of them said, "I'll come get you," because she knew I didn't have a car to get to the airport in the snow. And the other one made the flight arrangements. And then another one said, "From the other side of the country, do you need me to come out and hang out with you for the next week?" And I was just like, what? I mean, but you know, to know that even though I was probably going to step in to help you with all the logistics and all those things, but that I had that waiting for me on the other side was enormous. It was,
Yeah.
you know, it was like a buoy
Well,
through.
it sounds like your friends really knew, innately what to do to help you. And a lot of people don't, which is part of the reason why I wrote the book. And especially with suicide, people don't know how to talk. They don't know how to support, and they're dealing with their own horror about it and their own fear. So it's important to have those people you're talking about, but a lot of people don't have that. And so that's why this book will help create, hopefully create more people with more knowledge of what to do. And the other important piece we haven't touched on yet, but it touches on your comment you just made about community. And that is, what I've found in working with grief groups, and well, I started in the grief group, and then now I'm moderating. It's so important to have that connection with people. You're not the only one. You're not an isolated suicide loss survivor. You're not the only person who had a friend who lost a spouse to suicide. And if you can find a group of people that have gone through a similar experience, or a therapist who has worked with people, it's so supportive to know you're not alone in your experience. You are not the only person this has ever happened to. Now, your grief journey is individual, of course. Your experience won't be the same as everyone else's, but finding a network, like I've found through grief.com, of similar loss people is priceless. Because as much as your friends want to come through and come out for a week and help you and all of that, you may have noticed this when you lost your dad. I noticed this when I lost my mom. The ones who still had a mom couldn't relate to what I was going through. And the ones who had lost their mom really came forward. Some of them weren't even super close, but it meant a lot to make that connection, to have that same loss.
Absolutely. Well, the most one of the scariest parts of writing a book is starting to share it with people, right? Get feedback. You know, did I accomplish my intention? And is this going to do what I have spent these many years working for it to do? And so we have always in this community some people who are the first to be able to look at books and give that sort of feedback. And so I'd love to hear from those of you who had the opportunity to read Michelle's book, the first drafts of it, to just see what was your experience of it? What would you want to share with others about the experience of reading it?
Well, I know that for me, Michelle, there were some things that really made me stop and think about maybe how I have helped others in the past. And I was just finishing up having been in a position in my church where I helped with funerals and memorial services and things like that. I was really wishing I'd had your book 5 years ago so that I would have had that. But I loved the grief cake. I felt like giving them permission to just take that time and to be self-absorbed. I mean, I think our culture teaches us that we can't possibly think of ourselves. We have to think of others. You know, what's going on around us. We have to take care of all the details. You know, especially those of us that maybe are do that on a natural basis anyway, kind of have a habit of taking care of things and helping others. We forget to take care of ourselves. And I love that you give them permission and that you remind them that it's okay. And that even if it goes past a week, I mean, there's no time limit on that for you to be able to feel sad, or you don't have a 1 year mark and then you can no longer cry about it. You know, I'm like, how absurd is that? You know, I mean, when you say that out loud, like you said, would you ever say that to your friend? Oh, it's been a year, get over it. You know, you would never say that. But I think we're so hard on ourselves. So I really love the different steps that you had, but I really appreciated that picture of the grief cave. And it just made me feel warm. It made me feel secure. It made me feel comforted. And I just that was probably my favorite part about your book is that picture that you painted for them. The one question I did have, I think, was how with our friends, you know, like when it isn't their suicide, their, you know, their husband's suicide or their, you know, dad's death or whatever it is that they're dealing with, and it is a friend. What is a way that maybe we can help them if they are asking those wrong questions or asking, wanting to do things that we don't want them to do? I noticed in the book, and I want you to share, if you will, like what can you do to give them insight when you're in that much grief? I mean, like, how do you tell them, please don't ask me that, or I'm not ready for that yet. How do you say that to them?
That's really hard and a good question, but it is hard because we do want to take care of everyone and we don't want to hurt their feelings. You know, if they're saying, "Hey, come out for a drink. Quit sitting in your house all the time. It's not good for you." When you're in your grief cave and they're your friends, well-meaning, are trying to get you out. It's a really it is a challenge because you want to do, you know, you want to make them feel better because they're worried about you. But just I think using some of the things I've already said, you know, some imagery about, well, if I had a broken leg, you wouldn't ask me to go dancing. I am in grief and I am not able to go out and socialize right now. Please keep asking. Please ask in a month. Please ask in a week. I may be in a different place. So I think that way they can understand that this isn't the time, but that the time may come, you know, and that it's my timeline, not yours. And I know that my grieving is making you feel terrible, makes me feel terrible too, but I can't go before I'm ready. So,
And I think in
and
the book you
stop
also
with the chocolate chip cookies, or, you
try.
know, 6 dozen chocolate chip cookies is enough. Can we switch to maybe, you know, a charcuterie plate or some vegetables or something?
Your only job should be to give them more chocolate during that time. I'm just saying.
Thank you, Michelle. I appreciate that. I love your book. It's an amazing book, and I'm so grateful that you have put that out into the world and educating and people. And I'm looking forward to
Thank
it.
you. Thanks, Lori.
Can't wait for that launch day.
Can't wait for launch day.
I have a comment and also a question, Michelle. So one of the favorite things for me about your book was how practical it was. Like, it's one thing to say, take some deep breaths and go relax and XYZ, but you offered like instructions and directions for people, including the helper. And one of the things that really stood out to me in particular in the companion guide was it's very active. It's not like you telling your friend or their survivor, oh, do some breathing, go do this. You're doing it with them. And, you know, as a therapist, it's really hard to emphasize the value of like co-regulating, sitting and literally doing the breathing together or doing a walk together or talking about it versus like advice or lecture. And that to me was such a big part of that companion guide that I thought, this is so helpful, not only for the survivor, but for the person who's doing the supporting, because then they're doing all the activities too. So my question about that then is, as you were writing the book to help other people, how did you feel helped yourself by just doing the writing?
Oh, by actually doing the writing. Well, as we all know, it's saved by story. writing is a truly, it can be cathartic. It can be a salve. It can get, when you write your story, it can get you into those deep, dark places in the grief cave that you can't reach any other way and shine a light in there. Writing itself is just so healthy. And one of the practices I talk about in the books is journaling. Writing your story, telling your story. And for me, I think writing it with the idea that it would help others gave it more purpose. Because again, what do we do to help ourselves, right? It's all about other people. And would I have written the story just in my journal, just to get it out? Some, but writing it in a more thorough educational type context, I think maybe made it a broader and deeper exploration of my experience. And so therefore got into the deeper, darker parts that maybe I wouldn't have wanted to write about, or even the simple practices that, you know, writing about them, you know, while I'm writing, I'm doing the practices, right? So I'm like, oh, that's a really good practice. I'm going to remember that, you know, next time I'm not feeling well. Like Amanda had asked earlier about, you know, I had all these tools to use when I came into the loss of Glenn, and you know, how did I pull them out? And frankly, I didn't, most of them. It's really hard. So writing about the things I knew about, like, oh, okay, I know that, I can use that. So it's a little bit of a, you know, opening the encyclopedia of your own mind. Ooh, encyclopedia is probably a really dated word. opening the Google Doc of your own mind.
It's not dated. I know what it means. Don't worry.
I know, but you're very advanced for your age. I don't think you're a typical, are you, however old you are. I don't need to out you on that. But you get my point. You know, you're reminding yourself when you're writing that, oh, I've gotten through hard things. I can do hard things. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for letting me give it an early read. It was a really, really great book and be so helpful for a lot of people.
Thanks, Carlin. I appreciate that.
I would like to say that because I knew your story, and when I went to read the book, I felt myself gird myself up to face whatever I was going to face when I'm reading this book. And what was so surprised me, and what just washed over me a time and time again was how peaceful reading it was, how it whatever you did and how you did it, and reading through the exercises and doing the exercises, like Carlin said, the practicalness, and it calmed me down, even though I wasn't in a state of stress or grief over loss of a spouse in that way. It just reading it and going through it with you created peace, and the stress went away. And so I highly recommend it, you know, because I think somebody going to pick up a book like that might go, oh God, I don't want to face this, or, you know, what's it going to do to me? And I just have to tell any potential readers, it is an experience that you want and you need, because it is peace bringing and peace giving.
Thank you. Thanks, Teddy. I'm really happy to hear that feedback, because you figure most of the people picking up this book, most of the people that this loss applies to are traumatized. And I could have written very re-traumatizing stories about my experience and other, you know, people I work with experience. And the idea was not to re-traumatize, but to be, you know, a easy, friendly voice, you know, you've got this, you can do this, and not do so much of the deep storytelling that might, you know, or even force people to get deeply into their own story. Because once you do the exercises and read the book, you can be stronger and you can face the trauma with some useful tools to get to healing. Not that healing is a destination, it's a journey.
Yeah, it is. So, any other comments, questions?
I have a question. So I have basically zero grief knowledge. Okay, so I'm that person. So when my great grandmother died, that was a very different, right? I was very close with her, but I actually got to say goodbye, and I kind of grieved her beforehand. So the grief process for me actually happened before she died. It's very interesting. And the way that I healed through that was through writing. And then when my grandpa died, mom's dad, mom went to family in California. So I didn't get to be there for you to grieve mom as much as the family was. So I don't know, right? As a supporter. And so hearing you talk today was like really helpful, some of those things, but like me imagining being in a space with people who are grieving really deep loss, especially being in someone in my family unit, right? It's going to happen at some point in my life. You know, I now know how to take care of other people, and the book will help me, you know, reading that will give me some more ideas. But like going, when I imagine going into a grief cave with someone, that's their grief cave. So like, how do I also take care of myself going into someone else's grief cave while I'm helping them, so I don't go under with them, you know, in such a stressful, traumatic time.
Right. Because then you're not helping you or them.
Exactly. So, yeah. You're making it way worse for everybody.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great question. And I do address that in the companion book. It's really important, just like in the survivor book, to, I hate using this cliche, but to put on your own oxygen mask before your own. You have to take care of yourself. If your cup's empty, you can't fill someone else's. So, you know, why don't I just throw out three metaphors at once? But you get the idea. You have to be strong and resilient and grounded yourself before you can actually be a true helper, especially to someone in grief. Gosh, all these metaphors keep coming out. I'm going to just send them away and just stay on task here. But really, right? If your toolbox is empty and someone's trying to build a house, you don't have a hammer and nails to hand them. So you need to take care of yourself. And if you notice, if you're with someone in grief, and this is the tricky part, but so important, and I do talk about this in the book. If you're with them and you're starting to feel like your grief is overtaking you, you're not going to be able to help them. So you need to excuse yourself and go do whatever it is that, you know, do your breathing, your yoga, your walking, you're eating healthy food, you're binging. This is us, whatever it is, to get yourself back to a good spot. And then you return, you know, they're still going to be there. They're still going to be grieving, you know, and hopefully they can understand that you needed a break. That's the beauty of being the companion that unfortunately the survivor doesn't get, but you don't get a break when you're the survivor, right? You're always in grief. So.
Thank you.
But as a companion, you know, you get somebody else in there, mm-hmm. you know, take a shift, somebody else can take a shift. Yeah.
That's what I love, that idea of community, just having that understanding that, you know, I've seen it in rooms of people facilitating that like one mind sort of experience, right? Where you kind of know this person needs a break. This person needs to not be out in front or the main person right now. And just, you know, having that ability, that the communication to say, ooh, too much. And for it to just be okay. So yeah, I love that idea. Don't go in alone.
Yeah, and it does. It takes a community. It takes, you know, more than just one friend or one spiritual leader or one therapist. It takes all of them. Because it's heavy. You need a lot of people to carry this.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to walk alongside you while you've been writing this, and the privilege of being able to publish it through our publishing house. And I just want to ask, is there anything else that you would want to share with the people who are listening?
Well, I also want to thank you, because honestly, Amanda, and Teddy and Carlin and Aaron and Lori and Alyssa, who's not here, I definitely wouldn't have been able to complete this project without your support. So I'm just incredibly grateful. And I think probably to my listeners, to the listeners who are in grief, whatever your grief might be, whatever your struggles might be, my advice is to just keep trying. Something will work. Just give yourself grace and keep trying. Find another tool. The one tool doesn't work. One therapist doesn't work. One friend isn't supportive. Keep looking. Find a group. You know, you'll get through it. If you're listening or watching the video right now, you already got to this point. So keep going.
Yeah.
And even if it's writing a book, same thing, you know, take a break, phone a friend, call Amanda.
Survival skills are, you know, they're kind of universal, right? That, universal, that tribe, yeah, piece and the breathing piece. And yeah. Thank you again for being with us today, Michelle. And thank you to our listeners and viewers for tuning in to this episode of Sips of Story and Sanity. We'd love to hear what you're taking away from this. And we'd also really love your support of Michelle's book and getting this into the hands of the people that you know need it. So with that, I think we have a wrap.
Amanda, thank you so much.
I'm sorry. Can you, or Michelle, read the titles of your two books?
Oh, right.
Yeah. Oh, Amanda, do you have it?
I have them. I'll read them. So the first book is Surviving Spouse or Partner Suicide Loss, A Mindful Guide for Your Journey Through Grief. And the second one is Supporting a Survivor of Spouse or Partner Suicide Loss, A Mindful Guide for Co-Journeying Through Grief, which are both out on January 26th. And we'll be posting all about it. We'll have an event together in person, which will be fun. So yeah, go ahead and follow us on social media. Follow Michelle on social media. Michelle, where can people find you too?
Oh, great question. So my website is inhabitjoy.com. You can sign up for my newsletter there and keep in touch, keep informed. And also my offerings are on there. On social media, I have Instagram, Michelle Ann Collins _. Because I actually had Michelle Ann Collins and lost the password. So now I have an _. I know. Facebook is Inhabit Joy with Michelle Ann Collins. And then I also have a personal page that's Michelle Ann Collins. And I post a lot of the same stuff on both. But that's the best way.
Excellent. All right. Thanks again. And we'll see you in January.
Yay. Thank you so much.